a very long agenda today, so we'll be asking people to come up three at a time and to keep your testimony to 2.5 minutes. So we'll begin with Tom Green, Dr. Burt, and Phil Rivness. We'll start with Tom Green.
Thank you very much, Senator. My wife, Cheryl, and I are here today to share our thoughts and our ideas of the impact with regard to the governor's budget proposal to eliminate dental service for people on MA. We have a daughter who has special needs, and Cheryl will be sharing that story. But we're not only here on behalf of our daughter, we're here on behalf of the 100,000 other people with disabilities who will lose their dental coverage under the governor's proposal. So thank you for allowing us to be part of the hearing.
Good morning. I'm Cheryl Green, Cheryl with a C. I'm Laura's mother, and Laura was born to us 41 years ago. She's the third child of our four adult children. From birth, she has had developmental disabilities. Her IQ quotient is 65, and she has needed special education classes and one-to-one support her whole life. She now lives in a wonderful group home in Bloomington, Minnesota. She's had special education classes, and now at 41, she works as a greeter at Olive Garden because of all the wonderful programs that we've had for Laura to help her move along, and she's worked there. She's going to get her 10-year PIN this year. She has a job coach on site to support her. Without the wonderful services that MA has provided, and I'm talking specifically today about dental, Laura's health would be very poor. She has been treated over 25 years at HCMC with wonderful care, excellent care, excellent compassionate care, and her doctor at the present time is Dr. Rick Markowski, who has really helped her keep healthy. I know all these things because I have taken Laura to every dentist appointment her whole life, and just a couple of times the staff has taken her. Her small motor difficulties, her high palate, her gum disease because of medication she needs to be on, all of those contribute to necessary regular visits to the dentist. And as far as I understand and have researched, no dentist will take Laura because she's on Medicaid and Medicare. So she has had jaw surgery to help her chew her food better, and throughout her life she can eat healthy. She has had root canals, and now she has a partial because of a car accident she was in. And as I said, she needs regular dentist visits to teach her hygiene. I am very, very worried what will become of Laura's teeth and her gums and her health if this budget cut on the removal of MA patients from the ability to have dental services goes through. And now Tom will close.
We would simply ask you, senators and the governor, what would it be like if your sons and daughters were not able to have dental care? We believe that this is a subject is a major health services concern that our wonderful state must provide for its citizens with disabilities. We want to thank you very much for allowing us to present to you today, and we believe that you and your dedication will see that this elimination of dental services to our daughter Laura and all the people with disabilities in the state does not go into law. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Dr. Burt?
Thank you, Senator Berglund. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I've been in practice in St. Paul, Minnesota for 31 years. I'm a clinical professor at the University of Minnesota, and I'm past president of State Board of Medical Examiners under Governor Perpich for 9 years, which I was paid $35 a day. Thank you very much. In 1992, as part of a comprehensive reform, the legislature created a broad plan. Senator Berglund was very much a part of that, designed to increase access to affordable health care for all Minnesotans. To pay for this initiative, it created a new tax on health care services. We all know that to be the provider tax, put the proceeds into the Health Care Access Fund. And the idea was that this fund would be used to give more Minnesotans access to preventative and primary care. That, in turn, would lower health costs by everyone by reducing uncompensated care, preventable emergency room visits, and other costly medical procedures. Doctors like myself, health care workers, and hospital administrators were very much opposed to being singled out as the only professionals to pay the provider tax. However, I was involved in those discussions, and we all accepted the plan because we were told the fund had appropriate safeguards that would allow the collected money to be used only to increase access to care for sick patients. But unfortunately, the Health Care Access Fund has changed to something completely different under the administration of Governor Pawlenty. In an effort to balance yet another state budget deficit, Governor Pawlenty has proposed using nearly $400 million from the Health Care Access Fund to make up for lower than expected state tax revenues. That is in addition to the hundreds of millions of dollars the administration has taken from the fund to balance previous deficits. This money should not be the governor's piggy bank. This outrageous attempt to raid this dedicated state health care account is, in our opinion, not only immoral, but unethical. We literally have hundreds of thousands of patients who need high-quality health care but have no insurance, do not qualify for programs such as Medicaid, medical assistance, or Minnesota Care. And this year, he wants to take the entire amount, yet continue to tax physicians and hospitals and not use it for health care. My wife, who is a registered nurse, volunteers every week at one of St. Mary's 13 free health care clinics in the Twin Cities. These clinics function with private money. Our staff completely volunteer physicians, nurses, and receptionists. Every day the clinics are open, there are long lines with people waiting to be served. It's not uncommon to find hardworking people among those clients. They don't have significant incomes. It's difficult for them to qualify for the health care programs subsidized by the state or federal governments. For example, if you're single and you make $20,000 a year in Minnesota, have $10,000 in assets like a car, you're considered too well off to qualify for Minnesota Care, the state's subsidized health insurance program paid for by the Health Care Access Fund. Only 130,000 people qualified last year, meaning less than 40% of the Health Care Access funds were used for medical care. So rather than raising the threshold to allow for more uninsured Minnesotans to qualify, and rather than lowering the provider tax, the administration has used this money to pay for all sorts of miscellaneous state expenses. Raiding the Health Care Access Fund to balance the state budget at a time like this is not only inappropriate, but also short-sighted. We owe it to the people paying the tax and to sick people to use those funds to improve access for Minnesotans who have been priced out of the health care market. The Health Care Access Fund was created to help people, not to allow politicians to hide from tough budget choices. The physicians of this state are asking of you to use this money obtained from physicians and hospitals for its intended purpose, to care for the sick people. It is your moral and ethical duty to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Burt, and for whatever it's worth, I agree with you.
Thank you.
Phil Rivness, Dr. Roush, and Walter Cooney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You certainly have your work cut out for you in this very, very difficult economic times, and I can recall being on that side of the table, but never with the kind of shortfalls that you're having to address. Having said that, though, I represent or work with the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association that represents about 800 clinics across the state, small and large, rural and urban, and we have some significant concerns with the governor's proposal. But there are really four that stand out to us. The first that Dr. Burt has already spoken to is our tremendous concern at the loss of coverage for thousands and thousands of Minnesotans. We think that that is the biggest flaw in the governor's proposal. that maybe as many as 113,000 Minnesotans who currently can access care, preventative care, good care when they have major issues, will now not have access if this proposal were to be implemented. This results in delayed care, more expensive care, misutilization of ER departments, and it's of grave concern to us. The second issue has to do with the reduction in provider reimbursement. As many of you know, there's only been one increase in provider reimbursement under a fee-for-service MA since 1992. That was in 1999. And a report issued by the Office of the Legislative Auditor earlier this year indicated that back in 1993, MA reimbursement covered about 62% of typical charges. That number is now down to 33%, so there's been a dramatic erosion of reimbursement. So we would ask you to take a look at that. I know, again, the choices are not going to be easy, but that is of grave concern to us. The result of that kind of a cut for many, especially smaller providers in rural Minnesota, could well be the laying off of staff, the closing of satellite offices that currently provide access to care. So it is a very, very important issue. The third item that concerns us greatly is the proposed repeal of optional therapies and services, things like occupational and physical therapy, chiropractic, podiatry, dental care. Even though our clinics are medical clinics, we rely on these services as options for patients. Not every issue that comes before a medical doctor can be treated or should be treated with pharmaceutical or surgery, but we rely on these kinds of therapies being available to our patients, and we think that this will create circumstances in which perhaps even higher cost care would be substituted for very effective care through these care systems. Finally, and Dr. Burt spoke to this very articulately, we're very concerned about both the rating of the Healthcare Access Fund once again for general budget purposes, but also the proposal to actually eliminate the Healthcare Access Fund and have provider tax dollars go directly to the general fund in the future. We think this would be a huge mistake. It's been hard to keep this fund intact, as you know, Madam Chair, but I think it would be devastating and almost impossible to trace the money from the provider tax, you know, to the people who that fund was designed for. So those are our major concerns. We know that you have many trade-offs that you'll have to be working through. We stand prepared to help and provide some options of our own in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Roush?
Madam Chair, members, I am Dr. Gina Roush, Doctor of Podiatric Medicine and immediate past president of the Minnesota Podiatric Medical Association. There are approximately 200 licensed podiatrists in the state of Minnesota. Doctors of podiatric medicine treat disorders, diseases, and injuries of the hand, foot, ankle, and lower leg of patients of all ages. We also perform partial foot amputation. Podiatric physicians and surgeons deliver over 85% of foot and ankle care for patients in Minnesota, and the vast majority of medically necessary foot and ankle care of patients in Minnesota Care, General Assistance, and General Assistance Medical Care, as well as Medicare patients. Eliminating podiatric physicians and surgeons will result in the loss of preventative and necessary services that they provide to the patients in these programs, particularly patients with diabetes and peripheral vascular disease and other lower extremity medical issues. With the epidemic escalation of such conditions as diabetes and obesity, Minnesota citizens increasingly require the skill of doctors of podiatric medicine to play a vital role in treating lower extremity complications. More than 60% of non-traumatic lower limb amputations occur in people with diabetes, and comprehensive foot care programs by podiatrists can reduce amputation rate by as much as 85%. The projected savings from amputation prevention strategies is between $14.9 and $21.8 billion. We work with primary care physicians, vascular surgeons, orthopedic surgeons, and other providers as an integral part of the medical team, reducing the risk of amputation in the diabetic population. We detect early warning signs and prevent and treat diabetic ulcers and other conditions in the lower extremity that oftentimes, if untreated, can lead to amputations which are preventable with podiatric diagnosis and treatment. Not only have amputation rates decreased dramatically with podiatric care, but foot ulceration reoccurrence rates were found to decrease by 48% with a multidisciplinary approach and four podiatry visits yearly. Not only are podiatry services cost-saving measures, but the medical effectiveness score of podiatrists was 3.9 higher, indicating more beneficial outcomes than that of orthopedic surgeons and other physicians. Patients who visited podiatrists for common foot problems reported significantly more beneficial outcomes than those who visited other types of healthcare providers. Eliminating podiatric service from these programs will not eliminate the need for foot and ankle care services. These patients will still need to seek care because limiting their access to care will not eliminate the morbidity of their problems. Rather, by eliminating podiatric services, the cost of care will increase because these patients will be forced to receive their care in hospitals and the emergency rooms as opposed to a podiatric physician's office. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Walter Clooney and Jennifer Lundblad.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Lundblad. I'm CEO at Stratus Health. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I'm here today in my capacity as co-chair of Minnesota's eHealth Advisory Committee. I'm here with my colleague Walt Cooney, my co-chair in that role. We're here to leave you with two key messages. The first is to express our appreciation for the legislative commitment to eHealth here in Minnesota and our support for the level of base funding in the governor's budget for eHealth. And the second message is to emphasize that more work remains to be done and more investment is needed. So I'm going to speak briefly to that first comment, and I'm going to turn to Walt to address the second. We know that e-health, the use of technology in healthcare, has been slow in comparison to other industries. We have not adopted and used technologies to increase efficiency, quality, patient safety, and reduce costs the ways that we could. But now, thanks to the legislative commitment that you've all demonstrated, we have two mandates in front of us. By 2015, all providers shall have an interoperable electronic health record here in Minnesota, and by 2011, e-prescribing will be in wide use. These two mandates have really served as a catalyst for action here in Minnesota, and I think we should be very proud that our state has put together an e-health advisory committee, a public-private partnership of a variety of stakeholders from a variety of different perspectives who've come together to build consensus, to do planning, and to provide education and training. You've received the report from our Commissioner of Health just recently in January of this year, outlining the 2008 accomplishments. And one of those is that we are one of only a handful of states that through this eHealth Advisory Committee have been able to develop a statewide implementation plan for electronic health records. We should be very proud of that, and our adoption rates are in fact higher than in many other parts of the country. We also hold each summer an eHealth Summit that brings together, last year for example, more than 400 people who are coming together for learning and sharing and networking. And again, while each individual provider organization or health system needs to make its own decisions and investments about their use of technology, what we know is that a coordinated body such as the eHealth Advisory Committee can really help advance where we're going. We can be a voice of common consensus, agreement on standards, and agreement as to the tools and resources so that we don't inefficiently recreate the wheel as we move forward. So none of these things would be possible without the base funding that's now included in the governor's budget, so we are strong supporters of that inclusion, but we know that much more work remains to be done. So I'm going to turn to Walt to comment on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Berglund and committee members. My position as executive director of the Neighborhood Healthcare Network, which is a consortium of community clinics that serve the under and non-insured in the Twin Cities metro area. But speaking and looking at the impact of the eHealth program statewide, I'm going to speak specifically to the grant and loan program that the legislature appropriated almost $14 million in funds for grants and loans, primarily to safety net clinics and rural providers. Without the grant and loan program, administered through the Minnesota Department of Health, many rural and safety net clinics and hospitals would simply not be able to afford this technology. And while the adoption rate statewide of major healthcare systems in the state of Minnesota is high, there still are significant gaps in the adoption rate of this technology, again, in critical access hospitals, rural communities, and other specialty providers such as nursing homes. The governor's budget does not provide any money in the next biennium for grants and loans. The funding that was appropriated in the last biennium was easily spent with a significant amount of dollars that were, in a sense, unmet need. For example, for the grants program, $8.3 million was appropriated, but there were proposals in that represented a cost of $27 million. And for the loan program, $6.3 million was appropriated, and there was an unmet need of about $14 million. The passage of the economic stimulus bill by Congress and signed by the President yesterday will create an enormous opportunity for this state to capture some IT dollars to improve the adoption rate in this state. We're not sure at this point in time how much money might be available and what the specific matching requirements will be, but at least in its initial stages, the state might be able to capture as much as $11 in federal money for every $1 of state appropriation. Through the Minnesota Department of Health and the eHealth Advisory Committee, Minnesota is strongly positioned to capitalize on this opportunity. Number one, we have a plan for full adoption that was adopted through the eHealth Advisory Committee. There is a mechanism already established through the Department of Health to distribute funding to the neediest provider groups around the state. And so we request your consideration of an appropriation to replenish those funds and capture the federal dollars that are available.
I'm just going to interrupt you because we are having a hearing on this topic next week.
Okay.
And we'll have more time to talk about it then.
Great.
And you've each gone over your 2.5 minutes.
All right. Thank you. Welcome that opportunity. Thank you.
Dr. Burkett, Dr. John, I guess. I'll figure out how to say that name when you get up here. And Heidi Meyer.
Senator Berglund, members of the committee, we're going to speak with you briefly about People Incorporated's epilepsy services. People Incorporated's epilepsy services were started in 1988, the first and continues to be the only program of its kind in the state that helps people with intractable epilepsy get the support they need to move toward independence and live in apartments for the duration of their lives. This program was a pilot project in 1988 that actually Senator Berglund was involved in setting up. In 1999, 11 years later, it was finally put into the base after years of demonstrating effectiveness, with moving scores of people with epilepsy, most of who have mental illness, to independence. And it's been thriving ever since. The evaluation we got last year from DHS was stellar. I have a letter here from a neurologist whom you can read, who raves about the program. And I'd like to turn first to a client, Susan Welishner, who will say a little bit about her experience.
I'm speaking on behalf of the transitional DHS grant associated with People Incorporated. I moved into the program in 1990 when it was called SEARCH. I came from Duluth, Minnesota, because services and doctors were limited in Duluth. When I moved to Minneapolis in the SEARCH program, there were many more services for people with epilepsy. It has been my help and support for me to feel like I can live my life and that I too have a voice and say in my life and what I do. They are there to give help and direction when I need it. During my time with the epilepsy program, I had an ILS worker that helped me learn skills to live on my own and get to know my new surroundings. That support in turn gives me values and I can go and do things which have built up my self-esteem and confidence that I never had before. Plus, it also makes me see I can do things for myself and make it on my own. I have my own apartment. I work 3 days a week, and I go to outside activities available to me, which are important for my mental health. I would like to see others come to the program and get the need and help and support I've gotten so they, too, can have a try at life and living. This, in turn, will enhance their self-esteem and help them grow as a person so they can take care of themselves instead of others having to take care of them, like aging parents who in turn need help themselves.
Thank you. And now I'd like to briefly turn to Connie DeLorme, Dr. Connie DeLorme, a parent of one of our former clients.
I'm one of those aging parents who are concerned about their son. My son, I'm from Rochester, Minnesota, and there was nothing for him in Rochester, and we came up to the cities after we heard about Search through the local Epilepsy Foundation. Craig has been living independently since 1998 in Minneapolis, and the support that I wanted to point out to you is that when he seizures, they're his first responders. He pushes a little button, and they come and take care of him. If that was not the case, you're talking ambulance calls, you're talking emergency rooms, cost savings alone for what my son would require during a year are significant. And plus, if we take a look at all the other members that they support, they provide a service that is really cost-saving to the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund, members of the committee, I now got two people who are going to testify very briefly about People Incorporated's Safe Haven program. That's a program that actually was initiated conceptually by the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota and People Incorporated in 2001. After we had been working for years with people with mental illness who live outside, we felt it was time to bring them inside and give them 24/7 professional service. So Dr. Schultz and I conceived of this plan to develop the first safe havens in the Midwest for folks with mental illness who've been living outside. We raised more than $1 million to do that between 2001 and 2005 from more than 900 donors. We began then offering the services in two houses, one in St. Paul and one in Minneapolis in 2005 in partnership with the University of Minnesota, and we have been thriving ever since. In 2007, we were granted money, public money, to replace the private money so that we could continue this service, and that funding is in the base. I'd like to now introduce Dr. Vucetic, who is from the University of Minnesota Department of Psychiatry and has been with us since we opened in 2005.
Thank you, Senators, for the opportunity to speak. I'm a faculty member at the U of M Department of Psychiatry, with an interest in serious and persistent mental illness, and have been the psychiatric consultant to People Incorporated Safe Haven Services since 2005. And the reason I think that this program is so important is that it is a much more efficient way of helping people who have been homeless for a long period of time transition to permanent housing and a better life. The impact on human suffering and humanitarian concerns is huge. It also has a lot of impacts on nuisance crime and other expenses that government faces. I was initially very enthused about the program, but was unsure how successful we would be, because these are people who have often fallen through the cracks of regular health care and human services systems. But I've been very impressed over the past 4 years that with the help of nursing services, psychiatric services provided by myself and some senior resident trainees at the University of Minnesota, we are able to help people not only in the two residence houses in Hennepin and Ramsey County, but through the broader homeless outreach programs in Ramsey and Hennepin County to get into housing, to get engaged first, to get into housing, to transition through our programs, to get into permanent housing in which people have been very successful in sustaining, and then to ultimately transition to community care and into a better life involving often educational training and employment. And I think it's just been a very efficient use of resources.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Vuketic. Now I'd like to introduce one of our clients who's a graduate of our safe haven in Minneapolis, Audie Lucius.
Correct. Yes, Audie Lucius, and I've been here in Minnesota since 2005, and I left Chicago just due to the fact that I was looking forward to making a geographical change and, you know, just start, get a new start, you know. So I came here in 2005. From Chicago to Minnesota, and I didn't know anybody here, and I didn't know the resources, but I managed to run into a guy. He told me about the resources, and he told me about places I could go to get help, you know, for the needs that I was seeking. And I went to treatment for my chemical dependency issues around that same time, and then I was told by one resident in the treatment program that I was in about this program, and People Incorporated. And I kept calling them and just kept on staying in touch with them, let them know I really wanted them, you know, wanted to be a part of the program. And then they pulled me in, and they were real supportive of me with my issues, my mental issues, my depression, and, you know, just supportive of me, not just for the housing situation, but they were supportive of, you know, a personal issues I was having back at home with my family and kids in Chicago. And, you know, they were supportive of me all around, you know, overall supportive of me, you know, whatever. Whenever I needed to speak with somebody, they was there to listen and not try to judge me right off. They was just listen and be supportive and give me insight and suggest things to me. You know, I took the suggestion if I wanted to take them, you know, whether I want to take them or not, they was supportive of me and they gave me good insight. So, you know, I mean, it's working out pretty good. I've been in my own place since St. Paul since January 6th. I've been there going on 2 months, and it's been going pretty good. You know, the housing specialists, the case managers, and everybody here is all, you know, just overall all supportive of me. And I just feel like it's up to me to keep doing what I'm doing and just keep maintaining and keep a positive attitude about where I'm at right now. And it gets better, and it's going to be better. You know, sometimes it's going to be ups and downs, but I know I can make it through because I got a lot of support surrounding me, and I'm supportive of myself, and I'm trying to desire to do it and keep it going one day by day. So that's my experience.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm a little bit confused about where we are on the agenda now. Is Heidi Meyer here?
Yeah.
Okay. And Pam Gonella and Clifford Poltz. And Heidi, you can go ahead and start while others are coming up to the table.
Okay. Hi, I am Heidi Meyer. I talk with a smile, and please do not take away from me. My name is Heidi Meyer. I live in Dakota County, West St. Paul. I am here today to ask you to stop Governor Pawlenty proposing the eliminating of dental services for adults on medical assistance or Minnesota care. I would like to tell you about the medical assistance MA dental care program. Myself and others, I was born with dental problems. My mom and dad found out when I went to my first dental appointment how bad it was. My mouth was too small for all the teeth, normal teeth. Some teeth were coming in on top of each other, and surgery was needed to get the teeth and face lined up. There were years of follow-up during different things. My mom and dad paid for lots of dental work and surgery to keep my mouth healthy when I was a child. And when I was 19, because of my disability, my dad was told by the doctor to sign me up for medical assistance MA, and that it came with dental care as part of it. And when I was in the first group home, I got a dentist that would take medical assistant MA people. And when I had my first dentist on medical assistant MA, he made it so I did not have to go to the ER to have a bad tooth looked at. The first dentist I had dropped the nursing home medical assistant MA in some low-paying dental plan. In the second apartment, I got a letter saying I needed to look for a new dentist. It took a very long time to find a dentist that would take my medical assistant MA, but I finally did, and then the second dentist was talking to me about dropping medical assistance MA because of the $500 per year dental cap at the time. He also talked about the low pay and paperwork. The next time I called the lady, she asked what plan I was on, and I told the lady medical assistance. The lady said, we do not take medical assistance, and that is how I found out that I do not have a dentist anymore. It took a very long time to find a new dentist. A human services worker who had known me in the past finally helped me find a dentist who will take medical assistance, and I would have had very bad teeth if I did not have access to dental care services. So help keep my dentist and my healthy teeth for years to come. I talk with a smile, and please do not take it away from me. Help me and others keep our teeth healthy. And thank you for letting me tell my story to you. And I am available to answer questions or respond to any comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi. You've done a very good job today. Pam?
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Pam Ganella, and I live in Eagan. I am the mother of a 26-year-old daughter, Sarah, who's severely disabled. We have cared for her at home for over 20 years with the help of services from the state of Minnesota, and for that our family is eternally grateful. Sarah was a normal child till she was 5 and a half, when she developed viral encephalitis that destroyed about a third of her brain. Our bright and beautiful girl became unable to speak. We have to feed her, dress her, bathe her, change her diapers. She walks, but she is not able to protect herself from dangers, and she's partially blind. She has seizures and loses her balance. She requires constant supervision. Sarah was on the waiting list for the Developmental Disabilities Waiver Program for 12 years, so I understand some of the concerns of the almost 5,000 people who are currently on the waiting list for waivered services. The governor's proposed budget would limit the number of waiver slots and result in more people joining the waiting list. At this rate, many families who need services will be waiting for quite a long time. Sarah needed a waiver slot when she was leaving the school district, and we were fortunate enough to get one so that she could attend a day program. Sarah just loves her day program. She jumps out of bed every morning with a smile on her face, ready to go to work. Fortunately, others who are leaving school and need a day program this year may not be so lucky. We almost lost her day program when they made cuts in the consumer-directed option of the waiver. We had to transfer to another less flexible option in order to continue to receive her day program. The day services were even more vital 2 years or 3 years ago when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. All the while I was doing my chemo and radiation, the day program was there for Sarah to go to during the day, and her PCAs took extra hours to help our family. We were able to keep her at home rather than place her in a group home, and this waiver allowed us to keep our family together, and I'm sure that many families who are on the waiting list now need the waiver just as much as we have. The governor's proposal will have other cuts to waivered budgets and to providers. I don't know how they are going to affect us. I know that these are coming at a time when my husband and I are getting less physically able to care for our daughter. I had a knee replacement last year, and I know that these potential cuts are causing great anxiety to our family and probably to many other families around the state. I also am concerned about the dental care. Our daughter grinds her teeth, and our dentist was afraid she was going to lose them. We had to do a procedure to build up her teeth, and it took 2.5 hours under general anesthesia in order to do that. Since she lives at home, she's covered by our health and dental services, and we paid for part of this also. It just hurts my heart to think about all the people who would not be having dental services and would go through pain and discomfort because of that. These are just some of my concerns with the governor's budget proposal as it affects people with disabilities and their families. I want to thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Cliff Potts.
Good morning, Senator Bernigan and members of the committee. My name is Cliff Potts. I'm a resident of Minneapolis, and I've lived in the community for many years. I am able to do this partly because I have support three times a week from a staff person who gets paid through medical assistance waiver program for persons with disability. My staff comes in for 3 hours a day. She helps me do a number of daily tasks that I cannot do for myself, like laundry, mopping the floor, and other housekeeping, assisting me with my shower and getting dressed. And my worker helped me pick out my outfit for today so I can look good here at the hearing. I know firsthand how important those services are. I urge you not to cut them. I also want to express my opposition to the government's proposed cuts to occupational and physical therapy services. Those are medical assistance. I do not understand how those cuts could save money. The department has talked about reducing hours. Now, it's confusing enough the way it is without them coming up with a weird system to figure out what hours I get. In my case, I would have surgery on my back. If I have to, it would cost more to do surgery than physical therapy I am receiving now. I also pay $38 a month for medical care through MA for employees presumed disabilities. So I'm contributing to the cost of my care, plus I'm a taxpayer. My friend who was on MA could be hurt by the physical therapy cut. She is getting knee surgery in May, and I know her doctor would order PT after surgery to strengthen her knee. She would be unable to do physical therapy if you approve the governor's cuts. I also want to express my support for full funding for the region tank quality assurance program. I've been around for 30 years, and for the first time in my life, I see a program where self-advocates, parents, and professionals can sit along at the table and talk about a plan that everybody can agree on. Why would the governor want to cut a program that would, in essence, satisfy the feds' quality assurance piece? That makes no sense. Then the department has to explain to the feds, what is your quality assurance program? When they can't explain it, the feds are not going to be happy. And when you can't explain that, because the problems on needle prove that the police got good quality assurance, they want something that this program works, and if it can be done in Region 10, it can be done throughout the state. So to cut this is dumb. I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify. I will be able to answer any questions.
Thank you all for coming. You look very nice, Cliff.
Thank you, Linda.
Next, we'll take Mike Davey, Al Hester, and Lyndon Gaboy. And I remind people that we're trying to limit testimony today to 2.5 minutes each. And while people are getting settled at the table, I would just remind everyone that we are taking suggestions for other ways to reduce the budget. Obviously, we're not going to be able to leave the session with this large of a budget deficit without making reductions. So if people have other ideas, we certainly would like to hear about them. Mr. Davey.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators, members of the committee. My name is Mike Davey, with policy advocate with Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And I want to talk to you about homelessness this morning.
We'd like you to talk about a budget page.
Absolutely. Well, it's actually a page 337 in the in the Human Services budget pages, which is what I'm going to be talking about. As I talk about that, I just want to kind of put out there that there's about 9,000 people that will be homeless tonight. And so I'd say that's about 9,000 reasons why I want to encourage all of you, when you are fighting for the highest budget target that you can, that you fight for the highest budget target that you can for this committee. Because I want to thank you, Senator Berglund, and senators. In the last biennium, you made some incredibly important decisions to invest resources to address homelessness. They made a real difference in thousands of people's lives. It's true that some of those resources were non-base appropriations. And I went in, but for the homeless families, children, runaway or unaccompanied youth, and individuals served, this distinction really does not matter. All they know is that additional women, children were served. They were able to get the help they need. And in many cases, we were able to help people escape homelessness. And in other cases, we were able to help people avoid homelessness. And so I want to encourage all of you to reject the proposed...
We're trying to find page 337.
Well, it's
and we can't find it.
219A.
219A.
As it's renumbered here. I just found it. I was doing it.
Yeah, my apologies. I was dealing with a thing that came out, I think it was January 27th.
Continue.
Yes. Thank you. So I want to encourage all of you to not adopt the governor's vision for how we should be funding homeless programs. The governor's vision would fund homeless programs at about $4.65 million less than what this committee and others in the state Senate decided was important to invest during the last biennium. In 08-09, this body decided to invest $6.7 million in the Transitional Housing Grants Program. This means that about 8,000 families and individuals will have gained access to housing and supportive services, allowing them to secure permanent, stable housing. 750,000 of this was non-base funding. The governor proposes cutting funding for the Transitional Housing Grants Program by 12% when you compare his proposal for the 2010-2011 biennium to 08-09 funding levels. Does this mean that 960 fewer families and individuals will be served? I don't know, but I do know that we should be investing more in this very successful and sought-after program, not less. During the 08-09 biennium, the legislature invested $1.3 million in the Emergency Services Program. These resources funded the operating costs of shelters, street outreach, and essential services to homeless families and individuals.
Mr. Davey, I'm going to interrupt you now because you've used up your time. And I would suggest that if you want this program funded, you suggest something that we should cut beyond the $1.4 billion that the governor already is cutting.
And I would be happy to talk with you and other members of the committee. I would also, if we have the opportunity to potentially talk about ways that we could raise revenue, we'd like to talk about that as well.
You get the governor to agree, and I'll be the first one to sign the bill.
Okay. Thank you, members of the committee.
Mr. Hester.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Al Hester. I'm with the Public Housing Agency in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm also speaking on behalf of Minnesota NARO, that's the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. I have copies of my summary here if I could pass them to you. Thank you. I'm speaking about the proposed increase in what we call the MFIP housing penalty. Currently, $50 is taken out of the MFIP check every month for a family that lives in public housing or receives rent subsidy through the Section 8 federal rent subsidy program. The proposal in the governor's budget, and I don't know the page number, but I understand the proposal is to raise it to $100 a month, doubling the amount of the penalty. The main impact, of course, is on the families who rely on MFIP for their daily needs. But I'd like to speak just briefly about an unintended consequence, a spillover effect that essentially sucks money away from the affordable housing system in Minnesota. Because In public housing in Section 8, a resident pays 30% of their adjusted income for rent. So under the current $50 housing penalty, they pay $15 less in rent, and that mounts up across the state. We have 144 housing authorities represented by NARO. We have about 21,000 public housing units. Not all of them are families receiving MFIP. In St. Paul, it's only about 17% of public housing residents. But still, the statewide impact and the impact on a large housing agency like Minneapolis, the representative, or St. Paul is huge. We estimate the statewide impact of $100 a month MFIP housing penalty would be about $3.3 million. So that's unappropriating that money for housing. And I also don't have a suggestion of where to plug that hole, but we wanted to point out that this spillover takes money from the families. That's the primary effect, but it's also taking money from another high-priority area, and that's the housing area. I apologize. I mischaracterized the name of the committee here. I had housing still in the committee name from testifying previously. This is a perennial issue. It's an important part of perhaps a parallel budget. Okay.
No offense taken.
Thank you very much. There's nothing else that I have to highlight. It's summarized in my written handout. I'd be glad to answer a question.
We need to move on. So, Lyndon Gaboy.
Hi, my name is Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. And I'm going to be talking about three items from page 49, at least in the January 27th version, it was page 49. And then I'm going to be talking about the TANF refinancing and then some ideas on where we can get the money. First, I'd like to highlight the governor's proposal to cut $125 out of the cash MFIP grant for families who are coping with a disabled family member who's on SSI. This cut was in place for a while. We got rid of it, and it was the most humane thing that this state has done in a while. There's a few reasons why this cut is misguided and wrong. Number one, when a person is on SSI, that money, by federal law, by all the reporting they have to do, is supposed to go to the disabled person and not to anyone else. This cut essentially, when you look at it in that light, it either forces SSI fraud or it forces the disabled person to have to watch while the rest of the family is suffering because of them. This cut that the governor is proposing cannot be allowed to go through. The second thing I'd like to touch on is the idea of mandating 20 hours of paid employment per week in order for a family to be able to go to get an education. I'm sure you all know the current economic climate that we're in. This essentially slams the door on people trying to go to school. I mean, that's essentially what it does. And this is the time when we should be retooling to get ready for the new economy once that picks up. This cut is simply mean and simply wrong and certainly not cost-effective. The final thing on that budget page Mr. Hester's already talked about is cutting the family welfare grant by $100 if the family's in subsidized housing. We'd just like to reiterate that the cut is hard on the family, it's hard on the landlord, it's hard on housing stock, and it certainly doesn't help other low-income families looking for housing, and it does nothing but punish someone who maybe can escape homelessness, because most people on MFIP are essentially homeless. The MFIP grant for a family of three is $532 a month. That has not been increased since 1986. No one would be on MFIP unless it was the most dire circumstances. And when you are on MFIP, it is a dire circumstance because essentially you are homeless. Finally, I'd like to talk about, I believe it's budget page 54, and that's where the governor calls it refinancing the federal TANF block grant. Our committee calls it stealing. It's at least $25 million per year that the government wants to take out of the federal money that is meant to go to poor people on welfare and use it for other things. This has been done before, but it's wrong, wrong, wrong. This money for the TANF fund is supposed to go to TANF families. You wonder about where to get the money to help TANF families? Use the TANF fund for TANF families. Number two, if you're worried about the state being in a budget deficit, look at how we got in this budget deficit. We are in a deficit because the wealthy in this state have been paying taxes at a decreased rate for several years. It's a structural deficit built in by misguided tax policy for the wealthy. And what did the wealthy do when they were living high on the hog? They ran this country into the ground and put us in this mess where we are right now. They, and all those years that they've been living high on the hog, they've been telling us that we have to share the pain every time there's a budget deficit. The cuts come out of Health and Human Services. We're not sharing the pain anymore. It's time for the wealthy to share the pain. And I don't care what you have to do to get that governor to agree. You got to override anything he does to make the wealthy pay their fair share, get this state back on track, and quit victimizing poor people and disabled people and elderly people.
Thank you. We don't allow for demonstrations in the committee room. As you leave the table,
Madam,
I just want
to... Can I ask a question?
All right.
All right, Corn. Forget it. We don't have time. That's fine. I was just going to probably be controversial anyway, so probably better off that I don't ask a question.
As these folks leave the table, I just want to point out to the members that the TANF refinancing is $89 million over 4 years and $35 million during this biennium. Next, we'll call on Lawrence Massa, John Cheetah, and Sherry Glatton.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm here today representing the 147 hospitals and 17 healthcare systems in our state. We've provided you a handout at your place that identifies the 8 budget pages that will be targeted by my testimony. It also provides some additional information for you on the uncompensated care that hospitals are facing in today's recession environment. I know it comes as no surprise when I say that Minnesota hospitals are in a dismal financial situation. We did a recent member survey comparing third quarter 2007 with third quarter 2008, and it showed that net incomes for hospitals have fallen from a positive 4.8% to a negative 2.5%. We expect the situation to be even worse when the fourth quarter results are in, and we'll have that survey information soon. Contrary to popular belief, hospitals are not recession-proof. The recession is impacting all of our hospitals, both rural and urban. Uncompensated care, which includes charity care and bad debt, is skyrocketing at our member hospitals for a number of reasons. The proposed budget makes an already bad situation painfully worse for Minnesota's hospitals and threatens to cripple our ability to continue to serve as a safety net in our community. The cuts that I specifically wanted to refer to are identified on the budget pages. There's specific direct cuts to hospitals in a number of areas, including ratable reductions, elimination of disproportionate share payments, delays in rebasing of our hospital rates, elimination of the 16 rural DRG add-on payments, reduction in medical education and research costs, and further cuts to mental health care through an additional ratable reduction. Those cuts together total approximately $229 million in lost payments to Minnesota's hospitals. But as bad as those direct cuts are, they pale in comparison to the impact of eliminating coverage for the 84,000 adults currently enrolled in Minnesota care. We agree with some of the previous testifiers that is the number one priority as we look at it in terms of restoring eligibility to those adults served by Minnesota care. But we estimate if that doesn't happen, that lost eligibility could cost the hospital community over $460 million in terms of additional uncompensated care. Those numbers don't include the additional people who would otherwise be eligible for Minnesota care because of the economy. It just deals with those that are currently on the program. We estimate that Minnesota's uninsured rate will rise from 8.7% currently to over 10%. Representing an 18.7% increase in the uninsured. And as you've heard from other testifiers, people without health insurance and without coverage typically delay seeking care until their health care problems deteriorate and they're more costly to treat. They often then seek treatment in hospital emergency rooms because they know they can receive care regardless of their ability to pay. That's the essence of our safety net role, and that's what makes hospitals different from other providers affected by the governor's budget. And as you also know, emergency rooms are the most expensive place to receive care. So the governor's proposal does nothing to really reduce the overall cost of health care in the state. What will Minnesota hospitals do if the governor's budget proposals go through? The answer is painful but simple, but very simple. Hospitals will be forced to cut services and reduce employees because hospitals' expenses are typically 65% labor-related. Over the past 6 months, Minnesota hospitals have eliminated more than 1,500 positions, many by layoffs, and regretfully, more hospital layoffs are expected if the proposed budget is adopted. We also want to comment on the Health Care Access Fund. As you know, we were not enamored by the 2% provider tax when that went into place in 1992, but we do now agree that the Minnesota Care Program has been effective in dealing with providing a health insurance alternative for the working poor. We certainly urge lawmakers to protect the Health Care Access Fund, to keep it in place, and to use the money for its intended purpose, program enrollment and payments to providers. The governor's health care and human services cuts are deep and broad. We all breathed a little sigh of relief with the federal stimulus package, and we certainly know that it will help. However, it may be offset by the growing state budget shortfall, so we certainly understand the need for the legislature to continue to look at cuts. We encourage you to work with your colleagues to ensure that the new federal medical assistance percentage FMAP monies go to undo at least some of the disproportionate cuts the governor has proposed to hospitals. We serve a lot of people. We served 1.6 million people in our emergency rooms last year, 84,000 cardiac patients, 35,000 individuals who were in severe car accidents, 29,000 inpatient visits to our mental health units, and we delivered 75,000 babies. That's going to have a huge impact on our citizenry if these cuts go through. We encourage the legislature to look at establishing more broad-based cuts, look at all areas of the budget, not just health and human services, and we also encourage you to look at other revenue sources. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Massa, welcome. I know that you're relatively new to the organization. I wonder if you've had an opportunity in your new capacity to discuss your concerns fully with the governor's office.
We have had an opportunity to have some of our association members meet directly with the governor. We met with him about a week ago and encouraged him to look at the cuts, particularly in the context of this federal stimulus package. We also discussed the possibility of coming up with some proposals to reduce expenditures under medical assistance by coming up with some new opportunities, new ways of doing things, and our members are working on those proposals as we speak.
Mr. Massa, just one other comment, and that is that, yes, other areas of the budget do need to take their fair share of the cuts, but we also need to recognize that the governor did not balance the budget. And so if every area were to take their fair share and we were to balance the budget, the Health and Human Services share would be $1.5 billion. The governor has cut $1.4
billion. Understood.
Okay, let's move on then. I do not see John Cheetah.
Back there. I'm Bill Lindbergh. He's.
Are you testifying in his behalf?
Yes, I am.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Lindbergh.
I was going to say I am not John Cheetah. many people know John, and wow. I'm happy to be here, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Lindbergh. I'm the director of the inpatient program at Courage Center. We have a transitional rehab program at Courage Center, which is an inpatient program, which is kind of in the never-never land of being licensed as a nursing home but serving mostly people with disabilities who are coming out of hospitals with spinal cord injuries and brain injuries. I'm speaking mostly to page 105 of the governor's proposal and recommendations. I believe, unless the numbers have been changed, they refer to the recommendation of eliminating physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech-language therapy for medical assistance recipients. I also presented you a couple of handouts that look similar to these. And I won't go over that information. that's on there, but the front of it has a an item about a personal story. The back of it has some more information about our transitional rehab program. Last year, we served people from 38 counties in Minnesota. We serve, like I said, mostly clients with disabilities, a few with Medicare, but most of the people that we serve, and you'll see that in the information, are people with on medical assistance. The effects of the governor's proposal on us, especially for the people with disabilities, would really be a financial, devastating financial impact for us. Probably be close to $2 million for us and would jeopardize our program that we have. The importance of the programs that we have with physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy is to get clients back into the community. 100% of our clients discharge from our facility back into the to some community setting other than clients who have to return to the hospital for more medical reasons. The types of services that we provide really ensure people that require our services can get back into the community and serve a better life in that community. We believe in trying to get people to do for themselves, and our whole program is designed around that concept. And in the information that was sent to you, it kind of indicates what would happen as far as our clients are concerned if they had to move back into another nursing home, other type of inpatient facility. It would be devastating for us, and it would be devastating for the clients that we serve. I believe that it would mean longer-term stays in institutional facilities, which are more expensive than living in the community. We feel that all the areas of the budget should be considered. We also believe that the huge future needs of the disabled and elderly are really not being addressed in the budget proposal. Also, capping disability waivers severely limits our ability to discharge to the community. So I'd like to thank you all for listening here today. And if there are any comments, questions, I'd be willing to answer. But I encourage you to read the two flyers that I handed out.
Okay. And members, if you ever are feeling like you need a little more courage to do your job, I encourage you to go visit Courage Center.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Very inspiring place. Ms. Galanton.
Madam Chair, committee members. Haysha and Starley, if you could join me, please.
I'll have somebody up here with
yes,
you.
Please. Okay, thank you. My name is Sherry Glanton, and I'm Director of Youth and Young Parent Programs, and we have a program called New Chance that works with teen mothers from the ages of 18 to 26 with multiple children. And we're here today because we have been receiving state funding that helps us continue our peer support groups, which is real essential in getting the repeat pregnancy rate down. At this time, the state rate is 28%. The new chance rate is 8% for repeat pregnancies. Through the state funding, we were able to start peer support groups that deals with life skills, budgeting, time management, how to get a job. All of our young ladies are on MFIB, and they're required to get off eventually and get a job because of the five-year time limit. And these girls are the ones that are most likely to still be on or actually get kicked off after the five-year time limit and basically become homeless or end up with family members because they don't have the skills and what it takes to get a job and keep a job, and because they have multiple children and daycare costs and health costs and things like that are too high for them to be able to pay, especially if they have a low-wage paying job. The groups keep participants up to date on the MFIB rules and regulations of MFIB, which change often. Vital life skills are taught as well as pregnancy prevention.
Also, in order to keep the repeat pregnancy rate down, we need to continue to receive state funding at this time. I would like to introduce a participant of New Chance, and her name is Starley Struthers, and she's here to tell you a little bit about what she's been through in the program.
Good morning. I hope everybody is well. I cannot convey all that I want to speak today. It's a lot, so please open your hearts and minds when you hear me. This will truly, truly emphasize the significance of the New Chance Young Parent Program. My name is Starley. I am 23 years old, and I am a single mother of two boys, age 7 and 2. I first came into the New Chance Program in October of 2005. I was 19 with my first child, who was 3. I had just came out of my first experience with homelessness, and I had just received my son back from Child Protection. At that time, I first met Ms. Haitian. I already had a home, a job, and a car. Ms. Haitian and I clicked almost instantly. She explained all the services I can utilize and was very empathetic to my situation. All I needed at that time was a gas card to get back and forth. Honestly, when I first started, I really didn't care about the program. I liked Ms. Haitian, but I was just there to try to get what I needed, and I thought that this was her job. You have to understand, when I first came to the program, I was beaten up by life. I had low self-esteem, and I was in an abusive relationship. I just didn't care about life. I cared about surviving. In 2006, when I came back from living in Atlanta for 6 months, I found myself in a homeless shelter with a 2-week-old baby and my 4-year-old son. I knew who I could turn to. That was the year I fully became involved with the New Chance program. Ms. Haitian helped me with my transportation needs by giving me free monthly bus cards. I was able to use the computer lab to make my resume, and she gave me gift cards to Target to get an interview outfit. She then gave me a job lead to HMS Host at the airport. I got the job, and I wouldn't have been able to without the vital support from New Chance. I started school at MCTC in January of 2007. Ms. Haitian was very encouraging. That opened my heart up more, and our relationship grew tremendously since. Unfortunately, I was still in an abusive relationship. I tried to leave and was beaten unmercifully for 3 months. He also tried to kill me. I finally broke free and moved in with my aunt. I had lost my job because of the abuse, and I didn't have childcare because I was using my ex's aunt. I came to Ms. Haitian with scars and stitches. She consoled me and told me she was there for me. We worked diligently to find daycare so that I can return to school and find work. We were able to get everything in order. Things were looking great until my aunt kicked me out. I was homeless for the third time, sleeping in my car with my 5-year-old son and not quite 1-year-old baby. Ms. Haitia helped me look for shelter. I got into Mary's Place. I soon found another home, but as you can imagine, from moving around, I had nothing to put in my home. With Ms. Haitia's help, I was referred to a bridging so that I was able to get furniture, pots, and plates. I was recognized by the New Chance program in July of 2007 for outstanding achievement. I was so elated. Never in my life has anyone told me I was doing good. My heart gave way, and I let my ex back in, though. I told Ms. Haitian, and she told me to get out of it and focus. I can proudly say that as of October of 2007, I finally closed that chapter in my life for good, and I owe it to the undying support that Ms. Haitian has for me. I have grown a lot since then. Being a New Chance gave me just that, a new chance that I'd never had before. I mentioned Ms. Haitian, but I should also mention Ms. Sherry Gladstone, Ms. Jackie Range, Mr. Anthony King, Mr. Kirkland, and Ms. Rhonda. There's more staff that recognizes me by face and speak to me. Every time I go, whether to check in with Ms. Haitia or to use the computer lab, I feel as if they are my family. This is more than just an MFIP requirement or me getting their paycheck signed. These are people really committed to seeing me excel in life, and I know if I feel this way, then I speak for almost every other participant in the program. Where else are you going to find such truly dedicated people? Not in all one place like New Chance. They go beyond finding jobs. They give you the tools needed to succeed in life. They even go to great lengths to connect with our children, offering family outings which provide meaningful experiences. New Chance also offer groups for us to connect with others so that we see we aren't alone. I am so grateful. I stand before you now as a grown woman with a voice.
We do need to move on.
Okay, I'm almost done. I'm almost done. I don't look down anymore, and I don't shy away. I stand before you as a young girl who was orphaned by the age of 10 and was raised by a family that told me I will never be anything. I'll just die of AIDS like my mom. I stand before you today because against all odds, I can stand here. You take new chance away from me. You are making me fall. Thank you.
I don't have just 2 seconds. I know we're in a different arena, but I just feel like as a counselor, when you see your kid get up and do a speech or do something for the first time, it's awesome. And we're just here to empower and give youth and young parents the tools to get out and become self-sufficient. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you all very much, and good luck to you and your program. Jerry Kaiser, Marty Lal, and Kevin Goodnow. Is Jerry not here? Okay, we'll start with Marty then.
Hello, my name is Marty Lawal. I live in Brooklyn Park. Thank you for allowing me to testify at your budget committee meeting. I'm here to talk about the proposed cuts to Minnesota Care by Governor Pawlenty. At first, I was outraged that he wants to cut 84,000 adults without children off of Minnesota Care. First, I was outraged, then I got depressed and scared. How could this happen? I rely on Minnesota Care to take care of my health care needs. I am unable to work now and have no other means of getting affordable health care. I suffer from several chronic pain-causing illnesses and have to take many prescription medications. In 2008, the cost added up to $8,000 plus without my co-pays. My co-pays totaled $339. If not for Minnesota Care, I would not be able to afford my prescriptions. I would deteriorate mentally and physically. I suffer from fibromyalgia, osteoarthritis, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, major depression with anxiety. There are issues with my vitamin D and calcium levels, and I need major dental work. As you can tell by my diagnosis, I need a lot of medical attention. I see my pain doctor twice per month. I see the pain therapist in his office twice per month. I had to see an endocrinologist for every 3 months. I see my psychiatrist every 4 to 6 weeks, and I just started seeing a therapist for my depression and anxiety. My insurance copay is $3 per office visit. My insurance premium is $4 per month. I would not be able to do any of these things if it were not for Minnesota Care. I'm so grateful to be able to have it. What would become of me and many others like me if we are cut off of Minnesota Care? Are we supposed to be the sacrificial lamb so the governor can balance the budget on our backs? Many of us have worked and paid into the system, and now we need it. Doesn't that mean anything? What about the people with the very serious health conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, and others? What are they supposed to do? How would they survive without Minnesota Care? The mortality rate will surely increase. I'm here to ask that you not support the governor's proposal. Not only is it unfair, it's unconscionable. There has to be a better way to balance the budget without penalizing the ill people of Minnesota. Will you help find another way? Thank you for hearing me out.
Thank you for coming. Kevin Goodnow.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association today. The Minnesota Chiropractic Association is a professional association representing Minnesota's chiropractors, and I'm here to speak in opposition to the governor's proposed elimination of the optional chiropractic services for adults on MA, JMC, and Minnesota Care. It's our position, I know what the fiscal note shows and what the budget pages show, but it's our position that this proposal will actually not save money in the system. Based on a study comparing non-surgical, non-pharmaceutical approaches versus primary care physicians using conventional medicine alone, the following would likely happen. First of all, chiropractic is the lowest cost service in a lowest cost setting, and that with the elimination of chiropractic, it will shift costs to higher cost medical services. ER visits will likely increase. Hospital admission rates could go up to, based on this study, up to 60%. Days in the hospital for this population could go up to 59%. Outpatient surgeries and procedures could increase upwards to 62%, and then pharmaceutical costs could increase as much as 85%. With that in mind, and with the emphasis with the state looking at evidence-based procedures in medicine and looking at the proven methods at the lowest possible cost, we would encourage the Senate and other members of the legislature to oppose the governor's proposal on the elimination of the chiropractic benefits. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we'll call on Marianne Kuhn, Steve Breshahan, and Sheila Colum.
Marianne, you can begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Health Committee. My name is Marianne Kuhn. I am the State Director of Programs and Public Affairs for the March of Dimes in Minnesota. We have been involved with children's health issues since 1938, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt founded our organization to find a cure for polio. There are two key issues in the 2009 Minnesota legislative session that we feel are going to help meet the needs of pregnant women and infants. The first is access to health care. I know you guys have a tough job with the budget cuts, and we certainly appreciate that. The governor proposes to maintain only a limited state safety net program for single adults. Therefore, the 18.7% of 18 to 24-year-olds and the 11.4% of 25 to 34-year-olds who are uninsured will increase in the coming year. This may not directly impact the health of children today. However, this age group includes women of childbearing age, and the health of these women has a large impact on the health of our children. Preventive care in this population can offer great returns. For example, folic acid supplementation is proven to reduce the risk of neural tube and spinal cord defects. However, this supplementation is most effective if started prior to pregnancy. The second issue that I wanted to talk to you about today was the birth defects information system. This was established in 2005, thanks in large part to many of you who are sitting around the table. The primary goals of the birth defect system are to gather data on 45 birth defects, ensure families receive timely referrals, and implement prevention strategies to reduce the number of birth defects. According to the Birth Defects Program 2007 annual report, approximately 900 infants are born with birth defects annually in Minnesota. Since 2005, 2,408 children have been identified and entered into the system. The parents of 102 children with birth defects have chosen to opt out of the system, which indicates that parents are being informed and given the option to have their child's data removed from the system. Of the children remaining in the system, 992 have been referred to Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs, and 796 children have been referred to local public health programs. These numbers speak to the success of the program in the Twin Cities metro area, where it was initiated in 2005. The current BDIS, or birth defect system, was implemented with a federal grant but does not have adequate funding to cover all babies born with birth defects in Minnesota. In fact, only about half of all of the cases are captured, which also means that only about half of all the families get referred to the services.
Are you speaking to a budget page?
229 through 250 is where these are addressed. The birth defects information system is not in the governor's budget, and that's what we're looking for. We're saying that is a mistake.
Well, as you know, we're looking for testimony about the governor's budget reductions, not omissions that are not included in the governor's budget. Okay. If we were to take testimony about omissions of things that are not in the governor's budget, we could be here for the rest of the year.
We understand that. Then I would go to the access to health care. Thank you.
Steve?
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Breshahan. I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Diocese of St. Cloud. We're a social service agency that covers 12,000 square miles across central Minnesota. We cover the area from Elk River to Breckenridge, from Browns Valley to Lake Mille Lacs. Each year we serve 55,000 people. We serve the most vulnerable in our communities, children and adults with developmental and physical disabilities, chronic and persistent mental illness, vulnerable seniors, families with low incomes needing food, clothing, and shelter. We also work with homeless and homeless transitioning back into society. And we have several programs for homeless and near homeless veterans. First, let me stress that the stories that you've heard today from people, from people who have been receiving services, while they live in the metro area by and large, those same stories are all across this state. That's my first message. We serve an area outside of the Twin Cities, and yet the needs are exactly the same. I'm most concerned about the multiple impacts that often happen when program funds are reduced. As an example, last year we served over 100,000 meals to senior citizens in their homes under the Elderly Waivered Program, which is in the budget. If Medicaid funding for that program is reduced, we will be severely challenged to raise the additional dollars to offset the loss of funding. And that's because, like many other nonprofits, we're already raising significant amounts of money. We raise over $250,000 a year just for our food shelf services alone. But we know also that without proper nutrition, the health status of seniors often rapidly diminishes, and they quickly begin to need more expensive care and support, which often falls to the counties and the states to fund. Our Hope Community Support Program serves persons with mental illness in their homes, and it's funded both by state and county sources. When funding for county programs is reduced because of decreases in state funding, again, you have that spiraling effect, and so we have great concerns there. We know the challenges are immense in solving this budget. It's complicated and it's filled with political and societal implications. And so that idea of intended and unintended consequences is really important. Recently, Senator Amy Klobuchar mentioned that 74 cents out of every dollar that that state of Minnesota sends to the federal government, only 74 cents of that dollar comes back to us. Well, Medicaid funding is a matching funding often from federal sources. And so any consideration to cut Medicaid funding, I think, needs to be reconsidered because we, in a sense, are reducing in some ways federal monies that come in. Also, a balanced budget implies the balanced solution, one that is spread vertically across additional resources as well as reduced expenses, and horizontally across the many different parts of our society and economic structure, seeking an equitable share of the solution based upon the capacity to contribute. I say equitable and not equal, because we all have different capacities for giving of our wealth, as well as for giving of our time and our personal energy in supporting the work in our communities. We must remember at times like these that we're looking to the state government to provide leadership in engaging and supporting nonprofits, local governments, and communities in serving the most vulnerable in our society. We all have the same desire to sustain communities that are healthy and growing, to support organizations that provide for those who struggle, to create opportunities for those who strive, and to fully engage all who are committed to making Minnesota a better place. I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Sheila?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Sheila Collum, and I'm a caseworker for Catholic Charities in the Diocese of Winona. And our diocese serves the 20 southernmost counties of Minnesota, and we provide services to children, families in crisis, vulnerable adults and seniors, immigrants, refugees, the poor, and the unborn, all regardless of faith. Last year, we served more than 4,700 individuals living in over 2,100 households. More than one-third of these households had incomes at or below $25,000 a year. As a caseworker, I help individuals who do not have any prescription drug coverage find ways to pay for their medications. And I do this by helping them apply for patient assistance programs through the pharmaceutical companies, by guiding them through the application process through the county programs, such as medical assistance and Minnesota Care, connecting individuals with mail order programs and other pharmacies that offer medications at lower costs. And then we also have a cash assistance fund to help individuals who need their medications immediately through a short-term emergency assistance fund. Every day I see firsthand the struggles that individuals who try to pay for their medications and their daily living expenses. I have one client who works two part-time jobs because that's the only thing she can find, and neither one of them has benefits. We helped her with emergency assistance until she could get on Minnesota Care. Without the help from Minnesota Care getting her medications, she would not be able to stay healthy, continue to work and be a productive person in the community, and help provide for her son. I also work with individuals who lose their jobs and cannot continue benefits because COBRA is too expensive or they're unable to afford private insurance. I work with people who need daily maintenance drugs to treat chronic conditions such as high blood pressure, diabetes, and heart ailments. These individuals all have treatable diseases that can be managed with medication. What options will be available to these people? Finding jobs with benefits in a rural area is not likely, especially with the number of recent layoffs we have had in our area. There is already limited access to health care, food, and housing assistance. Some people will be able to apply for the patient assistant programs, but they can stop their programs at any time. Samples are no longer available through the doctor's office, and individuals will either go without their medications completely or they won't take them the way they're supposed to by cutting them in half, skipping doses, or just taking the medication when they feel really bad. We as a service organization will not be able to absorb the increase in demand for help. The proposed cuts to these needed and essential programs are destructive, both short and long term. These cuts are more than numbers. These are people. What message are we sending to them? That they're on their own? That your health is going to deteriorate and there's nothing we can do about it? We can't stand by as our neighbors get sicker and sicker or die because of the budget decisions we made as a state. Now is the time that we need to continue our care and concern for our neighbors, especially those who are poor and vulnerable. Thank you.
Thank you all. Kristen Brown, Lisa Lambrick, and Faye Nelson.
Senator Berglund,
we have copies of our testimony.
Senator Berglund and committee members, my name is Lisa Lambrecht. I'm here to testify on behalf of my profession and the clients we serve. I am asking that you reconsider the governor's budget proposal on page 105 to eliminate rehabilitation therapy services to recipients of medical assistance, general assistance medical care, and Minnesota Care. I'm an occupational therapist who provides occupational therapy services at Professional Rehabilitation Consultants, which is a community-based outpatient occupational therapy clinic, which serves individuals who suffer from serious and persistent mental illnesses. Our clients are among the most vulnerable and marginalized due to the severity of their disease and coexisting cognitive and physical limitations. The overall goal of occupational therapy and community-based mental health is to help people develop the skills and obtain the supports necessary for maximizing their independence so they can be maintained in their least restrictive environment, which equates to a least costly environment. A primary intervention is self-management of their disease, which increases independence and decreases hospitalizations. In the past, a client similar to someone that we currently serve would possibly be chronically institutionalized. In the past 10 to 20 years, for clients to be in the least restrictive environment, many of the state hospitals have been closed, and clients have moved to foster care facilities, group homes, assisted living environments, and to their own apartments and homes. Without support services such as occupational therapy, many of our clients would not be able to function at the community level and thus require institutionalization. We provide rehabilitation as an alternative to institutionalization. If our clients are unable to access rehabilitation services, the future cost, both socially and economically, will be severe in terms of institutionalization and untreated mental and physical conditions. We know what we do prevents hospitalizations, which are very costly. Approximately 1 year of slow restorative services at PRC equates to 2 days of a hospital stay. Please consider this cost. Please give me your support by recommending continuation of rehabilitation services. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to participate in this process. I will now hand over the microphone to two of my colleagues.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, everyone who's here listening. Thank you, Senator Berglund. I know the day is getting long and the testimonies are getting long. My name is Kristen Brown. I work as an occupational therapist at the same clinic that Lisa's describing in St. Paul. We serve clients in the community who have a mental illness, and I want to tell you about one of those people. Currently, we work with a 52-year-old male He has schizoaffective disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and chronic substance abuse. Even when he takes his medications, he hears voices that tell him to hurt himself and to hurt others. He has a long history of homelessness, incarceration, and long-term hospitalization. His average hospital stay has been 5 to 6 weeks. When he came to our clinic, he was experiencing chronic thoughts of harming himself and harming others, along with voices encouraging him to follow through. He had an explosive temper and was unable to maintain a normal conversation. He was also unable to maintain sobriety for any significant amount of time. And after attending our program twice a week for the past year, he is now a role model to other clients. His sobriety has been 100%. He has learned how to ignore his voices, and he has also learned to effectively manage his anger. And the cost for treating him at our outpatient clinic, occupational therapy clinic, is equal to 1 to 2 days in Regents Hospital. I'm asking you if you are prepared, not in the long term, but in the short term, to reopen state hospitals and to build more prisons. That is what I fear will happen if services like ours are eliminated for the mentally ill population. Please do not eliminate rehabilitation therapy from the Health and Human Services budget for people on medical assistance. Thank you very much for your time and your attention, and thank you for your hard work that you have ahead of you.
My name is Faye Nelson. I also work with Kristen and Lisa at Professional Rehab Consultants. I'm going to give you just a brief summary of one of my clients also, because I think that the results that we achieve in this setting is so important. My client is a 46-year-old woman with a long history of mental illness. In the past, she's struggled with alcohol and cocaine dependence, depression. She has a personality disorder. She has limited coping and interpersonal skills, which limit her ability to regulate her mood and develop stable social relationships. She's had multiple surgeries due to injuries, which she acknowledges are related to her mental illness. She has a long history of self-injurious behavior of cutting, unstable housing. She's been committed for psychiatric treatment, and she's had multiple legal issues, including a period of incarceration. The results of her occupational therapy treatment thus far include maintaining an apartment for the past year. She's had no further injuries, and she's now able to drive, which will further her independence in the community. She's attending AA consistently, maintaining regular contact with her sponsor, which is necessary to maintain sobriety. She's had no self-injury for several months. She has developed interpersonal skills which have improved her emotions and moods, increased her ability to get her needs met effectively in the community, and is developing a social support network which will further reduce her dependence on skilled services. She has decreased impulsiveness, which reduces her risk of relapse and vulnerability in the community. She has no psychiatric hospitalizations for over 2 years. And she will soon be attending a vocational program, which will increase her financial independence. So this is one brief case study, but we have many of these at the facility where I treat clients. And I would respectfully offer as a solution to the budget problems is to have more programs such as ours, which save money both in the short and long run. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we'll move on to Greg Lavelle, Robert Wood, and Heidi Gabbert.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Greg Lavelle, and I'm schizoaffective, and I want to thank you very much for allowing us to come and testify before you today. Madam Chairman, thank you very much, and Senators. Occupational therapy gives me a bi-weekly therapy session that helps keep me grounded. The better control my disease processes and its triggering mechanisms is less time that I have to spend inpatient in the hospital for 10 to 14 days at a time. It helps me with my agoraphobia and anxiety by letting me socialize with different people, which is part of my written goals, and it helps with my depression by giving me a structured location to go to it twice a week. It plain out gets me out of my house into a safe environment to explore my potential. It helps keep my voices to a minimum by interaction with the counselors and fellow clients and concentrating on a goal to be achieved. This helps me with the opportunity to create projects that help me develop a sense of accomplishment in increments day by day, week by week. Small things sometimes create a larger thing than was originally within my project scope. It improves my self-image, my self-respect, and it has helped me to come out of my shell, a difference my psychotherapist has noticed and greatly approves of. I also have a great need of a pain clinic that helps monitor my pain level and reduction from the medical procedures I have had to undergo, that is. I suffer from an avascular necrosis and chronic pain associated with it. It is the disease process that basically means the death of my lung bones because of reduced blood supply. This disease process was caused by the need at a rate of twice a year minimum of prednisone for chronic asthma. Growing up with asthma, I required it for extended periods of time. So far, I have had both of my shoulders replaced and my left hip replaced. My right hip also contains avascular necrosis, but is not to the extent that requires surgery as of yet. All these operations have required extensive physical therapy lasting about 2 months for each of my shoulders and 3 months for my hip. I had a separated shoulder last summer, and that required 6 weeks of physical therapy. Without physical therapy, I would not be able to walk well or move my arms with much more rotation. I also undergo chiropractor to aid with my shoulders, spine, and hips. Chiropractor visits help me with my ability to work out with 3-pound weights. That's all the more I can lift. My chronic pain has diminished some, but I have yet to be able to do one good push-up, a goal I hope to achieve possibly by this summer. But less pain is good and lessens my reliance on pain medications and emergency room visits. Without the chiropractor, I would be scrunched over from a surgery I had done to repair a hiatal hernia last December. It has been a hard struggle to learn to straighten my spine back up. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Robert?
Hi, my name is Robert Wood. I am mentally ill, and what occupational therapy means to me. Occupational therapy helps keep me out of the hospital by giving me one-on-one counseling with my therapist for as long as time as I need. It helps my agoraphobia by getting me out of the house and into a structured situation where I can work on small tasks that I can complete in a week, building into larger accomplishments. I also get to communicate with other clients in a controlled environment that has similar disabilities. My being here in front of you is proof of my improvement, a thing I would not have been able to do a year ago. It has helped me with my relationships with my daughter. I can now go out and socialize with her out into the general public. I was hospitalized 7 times in the last year prior to occupational therapy and 2 times in a crisis house. This has subsided since going to occupational therapy. I also have ongoing experiences with local pain clinic and a chiropractor, which has been a positive influence, and not having to go to the hospital and having back surgery at the age of 48. Thank you.
Thank you. Heidi?
Hi, my name's Heidi Gabbert. I am related to the Gabbert family. My grandfather was the founder of Gabbert's Furniture Store in Edina and also the Galleria. I'm here to tell you that mental illness has no discrimination from prominent to poor. I've been going to professional rehabilitation centers for 2 years. I've stayed out of the hospital for 2 years. I've been sober for over 2 years. I'm now living in an apartment. I lived in a group home. I'm learning new coping skills to manage my voices, depression, anxiety, working to learn how not to headbang. I'm able to drive a car. OT has helped me manage my diabetes by losing 55 pounds through exercise. I have discovered my artistic ability through gardening, arts and crafts, cooking, travel, entertaining. I have lots of new friends, and without OT, I would be in the hospital. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, all of you, for coming to tell your personal stories. I know that it's not an easy thing to do, but we appreciate it, and it's important to hear.
And also, I have a letter for the governor. If someone could give this to him, can I leave it on the table, please?
We'll have someone deliver it to his office. I can't promise if he'll see it or not.
All right. Thank you very much.
We'll have someone take it to his office. George Stone, Lee Blondes, and Julie Manwarren.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Correction. Unfortunately, Julie Manwarren wasn't able to be with us this morning. We have Mary Galini substituting in her place. When she speaks, I'll have her state her name and title for the record. As I said, Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for allowing me to speak today on the matter of how the governor's proposed budget will be impacting the supportive housing community here in Minnesota. I believe that we're talking about the pages 217 to 219.
Is this testimony about omissions budget or reductions of the budget?
Both.
We prefer to just hear about reductions to the budget.
All right. Respectfully, I will try and make sure that that's what I do here today. My name is George Stone. I'm with the Corporation for Supportive Housing. CSH is a national organization that provides financial support and technical assistance to communities across the country to create permanent housing with services and to prevent and end homelessness. In the simplest terms, supportive housing is permanent affordable housing linked with supportive services. It's a proven cost-effective way to end homelessness for people who measure their homelessness in years instead of days, weeks, or months. In light of the severe economic reality we're currently facing, now more than ever, we need to preserve the fragile housing safety net that we have in place. The interests of Minnesota's communities are best served when all aspects of housing continuum are funded adequately and readily accessible to those who need them. This means protecting our investment in supportive housing. Since the creation of Minnesota's business plan to end long-term homelessness in 2004, our state has made an investment of tens of millions of dollars in the development and operational costs associated with supportive housing. To date, this commitment has helped yield nearly 2,500 new supportive housing opportunities to our stock. Despite these investments, Minnesota will lose ground in the fight to end long-term homelessness if critical financial support is not made available to adequately fund the supportive services needed for those housing units. The governor has proposed a budget that reduces the state's long-term homeless services fund from the 2008 base level. It also does not include $2.5 million in non-base funding that is currently being used to support this program. Simply, this is not enough. Additional funding is desperately needed to fund services for existing supportive housing developments.
Is this in the Health and Human Services budget, this base housing reduction?
I believe so. It was a small reduction in the 2008 base number. I will double check that and provide
right,
the information.
Well, we'll keep looking, but we're
okay.
We're having trouble remembering this page.
This includes the funding is necessary for developments that are already in process and that have already received full capital funding commitments. I appreciate the challenge that you have as legislators dealing with a colossal budget deficit, and the instinct to reserve precious resources is understood. And while I don't have the answer as to where the additional funding will come from, I can tell you what will happen without it. We will see more people remain homeless. We will see families lose their housing and return to homelessness. We as community will be forced to continue our reliance on expensive, overburdened, crisis-related interventions such as detox, courts, jails, shelters, foster care, child welfare, emergency rooms, and hospitals, with little to show for it. Mounting evidence proves that we can either waste money prolonging people's homelessness or spend those dollars on a long-term solution that produces positive results for peoples and their community. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, I brought with me today two folks who are practitioners of supportive housing, and they would like to speak about how this is going to impact their particular programs.
Right, and again, we're trying to find where there was a reduction made to supportive housing in the base.
The long-term services, the long-term homeless services fund, I believe, was originally at the base at $10 million per biennium and has been reduced by a percentage. Then also, again, there was a 2.5 non-base commitment that's
currently. We're not talking about non-base. You know, that's a little bit like telling somebody you're about to lose your $50,000 home, and how can you go buy a $200,000 home? We can't talk about things that are not in the base when we're facing so much loss of programs that are in the base. But we do not believe that there is a page that actually is reducing the current base for supported services. So why don't you continue?
May I speak? Thank you, Chair and committee members. And I apologize. I'm Lee Blonds. I'm the executive director of Plymouth Church Neighborhood Foundation. I'm not an expert live yet, so I am the director of a nonprofit housing organization dedicated to creating housing for those most in need. And we are concerned about the impact on supportive housing for homeless adults, youth, and families. As you know, the governor has made ending long-term homelessness one of his priorities, and we're disappointed about the governor's budget. One of our particular concerns is that there is, and I apologize for going outside of your parameters, but one of our concerns is that there is no funding for supportive housing projects that have, in fact, received capital funding from Minnesota Housing. I know that as legislators you have very tough decisions to make, but I ask you to maintain ending long-term homelessness as a key goal, not despite these tough economic times, but because of these tough economic times. As a faith-based organization, we believe that those who have more must be asked to share with those who have less. As George Stone has shared with you, supportive housing has been demonstrated to be effective in breaking the cycle of homelessness, but also in breaking the reducing the cost that governments incur. Housing costs less than homelessness. Creating supportive housing is very complex. We need the capital dollars to build the housing, but we also need the annual funding for the service program, which provides the life skills training, access to mental health and chemical dependency programs, and support for education and employment. One of the very important needs this year is funding for supportive housing projects that have capital commitments from Minnesota Housing. It takes a number of years for complex housing developments to be put together. We need a system that is able to blend the capital commitments from Minnesota Housing with the service commitments from DHS. Our project, and you've received our brochure, Nicollet Square, would provide 42 units of supportive housing for homeless youth. Nicollet Square will be an innovative, work-fast program that will combine housing with on-site services and employment opportunities in a coffee shop located on the first floor. Nicollet Square has received a commitment from Minnesota Housing for $6.5 million, an additional $1.5 million from other public and private funders. With the additional dollars just approved by Congress in the economic stimulus package, we are shovel-ready. But we can't build Nicollet Square if we don't have the funding support to operate it. The majority of these young people have been homeless a number of times in their short lives. These are young people who have suffered at the hands of adults around them. Many have been physically or sexually abused. Many have been exposed to drug and alcohol abuse by the adults around them, and some have been thrown out of their home for their sexual orientation. I could share with you the statistics that these youth face in terms of prediction about their lives. They have a greater likelihood of teen pregnancy, being a victim of domestic violence, using drugs and alcohol, and ending up in jail. Given what's happened to them as children, what's shocking to me is not these horrible statistics, but the fact that these kids are fighting for a good life. 88% of homeless youth are attending school. Think of the money we spend trying to keep at-risk kids in school, and here are kids who struggle on their own to stay in school. Let me finish by telling you about a special woman I've met. Her name is Tatiana. she's spoken out about youth homelessness. She ended up homeless because her mother had become mentally unstable due to a traumatic brain injury. Her mother would go into rages, and Tatiana ended up leaving home thinking the streets would be safer. But of course,
we are going to have to ask you to wrap up.
All right. She was preyed upon by men out on the streets, but she was able to find a Metro bus driver who, against all rules, allowed her to sleep on the bus all night for a warm, safe place. She did this for months, too ashamed to tell anyone she was homeless. I'm happy to say that she does have a happy ending. She got into a supportive housing program like Nicollet Square will provide and completed high school, and she's now in college. Just to finish here, she won a national competition in spoken word. One of her pieces is titled, "If Home is Where the Heart Is, Then I Must Be Heartless." I don't think that Tatiana is the heartless one. I hope we can show her and the 1,250 other youth and young adults who are homeless tonight on our streets that we have a large enough heart to care for our young people with compassion and dignity. Thank you.
Mary?
Senator Berglund and committee members, my name is Mary Galini, and for over 20 years I've worked with homeless adults in Minneapolis. Currently I'm the program director for one of two women's housing partnerships and the SARA program, serving single men and women with Simpson Housing Services. We started in April of 2005 when we found James, a veteran with a dual diagnosis and over 20 years of homelessness, a place in North Minneapolis. Since then, we've expanded the program, known as the Collaboration for Housing Resources, to five teams serving over 200 hard-to-serve long-term homeless adults. We place participants in scattered site housing throughout the metro area, offering subsidies and supports. The participants have had remarkable success. Coming into the program, they average over 10 years of homelessness. Seven of the original 25 in the SARA program had spent at least 20 of their years of their lives on the street and in shelters. Imagine 10 or 20 years of having to share a public bathroom night after night, sleeping inches away from complete strangers on a mat or a bunk bed. And that's if you're lucky enough to get into the shelter. On harder nights, you might have to find enough blankets to sleep under an overpass or try to ride the bus all night. Women especially have to put themselves over and over again in unthinkable situations just to stay warm. All this would be a nightmare, I think, for any of us, but surviving in this environment with personal struggles of mental illness, brain injury, poor health, and addiction, I can't imagine even in perfect health, with all my wits about me, surviving in a constant state of vulnerability like that for a week, much less a year, much less 10. That's why I'm so excited about the incredible success the people in my program and programs like this have achieved. 80% have stayed stably housed since entering the program. Most in the SARA program have kept their places for over 3 years now. I gave Sam, a Vietnam vet, a ride to the bank yesterday to withdraw some money while we waited for a kink to be worked out in his food stamps. I've known him for over 15 years, and just the fact of having a bank account, much less still having money in there on the 17th, is remarkable. His addiction and mental illness aren't cured, but controlled, and each week as I visit, offering the support that he needs, I can see the progress he's making. He's now taking a locksmithing class. He's taking Anabuse to help him stay sober, and he's got money in the bank and been housed for 3.5 years after 12 years of homelessness. Using a housing first model where we choose the longest histories of homelessness and the most vulnerabilities, we no longer wait for till someone is quote-unquote ready for housing. We know that 8 of the 10 that when receiving support will be good neighbors, and it's likely that their landlords will call me and ask who else needs an apartment. George went over the savings and in the long run in terms of a decline in shelter, detox, ER, and corrections. And these kind of programs that offer support services to long-term homeless people not only have, I think, a compelling moral argument, but are also savings for the community as a whole. Next week, it's my 48th birthday, and I found out yesterday that if I'd been homeless in my life, that would have been my life expectancy, the age of 48. Let me finish by telling you about Sheila. She's 48 this year as well, and after being raised in a neglectful, if not abusive, family and spending 14 years surviving on the street, sometimes involved in drugs and prostitution, now 2.5 years into the program, her biggest worries are why her employment training program, where she's a top student, won't let her take a computer class, and how to keep her cat named Neighbor from chewing on the houseplants. Sam and Sheila are successes, and these are programs are a wise investment for their sake and for the entire community. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will go to Douglas Bruce and Patricia Lind and Carol Spector.
I'm Patricia Lind, and just for the record, it's L-I-N-D. Thank you, Senator Berglund and committee members. This is awesome to listen to the testimony we've heard today from individuals who have the courage to come before you. We're the parents of a 34-year-old daughter who is one of the proposed 85,000 people that the governor would like to cut as single adults from MnCare. We did send a letter to the governor, to Senator Berglund, and to Representative Huntley. We can only advocate for our daughter. I am glad that so many other people are advocating as well. It seems that there is a misunderstanding by the governor as to why people are in MnCare. It is simply because they have illnesses, take prescriptions, or have pre-existing conditions that private insurers will not allow them to be insured. Many of these people do work. Some are unable, but many would work if the private insurance world would insure them, which it will not. Our 34-year-old daughter has had a history of difficulty with thyroid disease, specifically Graves' disease, that then triggered bipolar illness since she was 18. In the period of time of following faithfully the treatment regimen that she's been given by wonderful endocrinologists and psychiatrists, everything doesn't always go the way it's supposed to. And she's had situations where she had a thyroid was surgically removed and then somehow magically regrew and had to be removed by radioactive iodine. These stresses on the body exacerbate the bipolar illness and have created many situations in which she could not be employed, though she has worked very hard to continue to do that. When she was no longer able to be covered by our private insurance, we went about the business of finding somebody who could insure her. As a student at Augsburg, they told her, sure, 9 years ago she could be insured for $700 a month. So that is why we went to MnCare, and we and she have been incredibly grateful. It has actually saved her life in a couple of instances, and again, she's only one of 85,000 people who would be cut. One of the things I wanted to say, too, is that we feel fortunate to live in a state which has a history which has truly been able to balance in a budget what is tax reductions but also people necessities. I'm grateful that Minnesota Saint Senator, I think it was a saint, Wellstone, and Representative Ramstead, after a 10-year battle in Congress, led legislation requiring insurers to remove barriers to mental illness treatment coverage for the country, as they had done in Minnesota. We are, after all, in the 21st century. It is a strong indicator of a compassionate and far-sighted society to not ask the most vulnerable citizens to pay disproportionately for the misfortune of being ill. Thank you for being here today.
I'd just like to add one comment. We've done very thorough research on what alternatives someone like our daughter has in the private insurance system. And it basically, in her case and many others, is zero. There are no alternatives to MnCare. They are either ineligible for private insurance because of conditions they bring to the table, medical conditions, and or, excuse me, my old debating experience is showing up here in my vocabulary, and or they are unable to afford coverage which they may qualify for. In either case, the coverage will not happen. So if you think of MnCare as a safety net, if you think of it in that terms, I believe that would account, I can't speak for all of the 85,000, for the majority of those people. There may be some in the system who would have private insurance options. I don't see that, however, as adequate justification for a severe reduction in the eligibility of the number of people who, as current users of the system, would suffer the alternative, which would be no medical insurance. We could not even estimate the total cost of the hospitalization, life-saving hospitalization, MnCare provided for our daughter. We again would thank all of you for your support, and again thank Senator Berglund for inviting us to testify. We appreciate your time very much.
Thank you for coming.
Yes.
Jerry Kaiser.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm handing out to you is our handout. I wanted to give you that so you can see all the organizations. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm a two-tour combat veteran from Vietnam. I'm also the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council that has a lot of member organizations in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to actually support the governor's portion of the budget concerning the veterans' homes. As you can see on the handout there that actually I didn't have enough space to put, there's over 35 veteran and military and auxiliary organizations that belong to us, and we come up here to lobby against for you or for the veterans, and I'm a proud veterans advocate, and we appreciate the efforts that you're trying to do to solve all this. These men and women that are in the veterans' home earned it, and they deserve to be kept there in the proper manner that they've been accustomed to. Gil Acovideo, the new deputy director of the Veterans Affairs, has done a great job in the year plus that he's just been there to straighten things out, get things working at the Minneapolis one. The other ones are standalones by themselves and are doing a great job there also. We support the governor's initiative in this manner and the budget, and would like your support in not doing any cuts there. I'll be short and sweet on this. It comes down to this. When you raise your right hand in the military, you go by the code of conduct, and the first code of conduct is this. I'm an American fighting man. I fight for the forces that preserve this country. If need be, I will give my life. We take that seriously. Now, the men and women are in this veterans home, obviously didn't give their lives, but some of them gave a portion of that sacrifice. They're missing parts. They've got diseases. They've got things that others don't have. They are a unique group of people, men and women. The majority of the people in those veterans home right now come from my father's generation, the greatest generation, and Korea, Vietnam. Vietnam veterans are getting to the point where they're starting to show up there. We have a number of them there. The Iraqi and Afghan veterans, they'll be next. And we just need to maintain that they need to have this available. There's only 950 beds in this entire situation. I just, I know that you've got a lot to sort through, and we ask that that you not change anything that the governor has in this and to maintain those veterans' homes and what the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs has said that they are going to do. I thank you for your time, and I believe I'm the last man standing, so you can go to lunch now.
Mr. Kaiser, I just have one question for you, and that is the legislative auditor identified that there was overtime being paid at the Minneapolis home that could not possibly have been worked, and that is now in the base of the budget. Do you believe that money should stay in the base and that removing it would do harm to any of the veterans who stay there?
Well, I would give a political answer to that. I'm not privy to that particular information, and I don't know how they work that out, that overtime. It seems to me that when they call the nurses and there's not a nurse there to take care of it, maybe the person who's on does have to go overtime.
No, there is room in every budget for overtime when you are staffing a 24-hour facility. We recognize that. But the amount of overtime was so excessive. In some cases, people were claiming overtime for hours that don't exist in the day.
Well, then that's wrong, and it should not be that way. And obviously, you're right. There are some parts of any budget that can be tweaked and looked at. We're just talking about not having draconian changes to it. I mean, these ladies and gentlemen have been talking here today. I feel awful towards this whole thing. We're in a situation we got to deal with, but I have to stand with what we
Mr.
feel.
Mr. Kaiser, would you object to proposals that would generate more federal funding for the veterans' home that could then be offsetted by a reduction in some state funding?
Well, the federal government can't supply everything right now. Of course, I don't know what the story is with this bill that came out of Congress where that would include any of the Veterans Affairs health care problems.
Well, the veterans in other states do get more federal funding for their facilities than we do.
Well,
and so if we could manage to get that same federal funding, you wouldn't be opposed to that.
Well, yes, we need more federal funding, but to get that funding before you do any cuts would be the optimum way to do anything.
Well, of course, we're looking for ways to balance a budget here.
I understand that. And it's, I just have to stand by what the, I'm not privy to all those numbers, and of course you are, you're much more talented than that and know those things, been around in this business a long time, and we appreciate the efforts of the committee, and we, I guess, what we want as the veterans and the UVLC is that our veterans are taken care of properly.
Well, we all want that.
Yes, ma'am. They deserve it. They earned it. God bless them.
Thank you for coming today. With that, we have completed our agenda, and we have completed the public testimony, at least as far as I know. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the governor's budget who's here today? Okay, with that, then the meeting will be adjourned. And members, if you want the contact information for anyone who testified today to follow up with questions, please just let my office know, and we'll give that to you.